the first item on the agenda, which is the President's Report. And this month, I'd like to try something different. I'd like to mention only one thing and actually discuss a couple other issues. The only thing I'd like to highlight is to thank the Pro Bono Center for holding the first walk-in legal clinic of the year this Saturday, both at the Northwest location and the Southeast location at Brentford City. In Northwest, there were 73 clients who were served, and Southeast, they had 41 clients served. I'm particularly delighted that despite the snow, 10 volunteers from my law firm, Finnegan, went and volunteered. So I'm really grateful for their support and participation and hope to get them back as future volunteers. Do you want to say anything?
Oh, just that it was a very successful clinic, and that Finnegan volunteers were, one of them was there to the bitter end. So we really appreciated your help.
Thank you. And we beat the snow.
Adding the UDC students were also there.
Oh, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We not only need attorney volunteers, but also paralegals are really important to help with the client intakes at the front desk. And they've been very instrumental, and they often don't get recognized. And so we'd like to give a big shout out to all the volunteers who make that possible. I'd like to forego the rest of my president's report in place of sharing a little bit with our board members. First, I'd like to call upon Lisa Dewey, who in December, as we mentioned, went to Nepal on work related to empowering women lawyers there. And perhaps Lisa, you can share a few words about that experience.
Sure. Thank you, Esther. And I'm really sorry that I missed the board meeting in December, but I'm really happy to tell you why that was the case. So, one of the hats that I wear at DLA Piper is I'm the director of a nonprofit affiliate of the firm called New Perimeter. And New Perimeter engages in global pro bono projects in very under-resourced regions around the world, where we put together global teams of lawyers to actually spend time on the ground, sometimes for a week or two at a time, working alongside our local partners. And I had the great honor and privilege of joining our team this time to go to Nepal. This is the fourth time that we've gone there. And we've been working with the Nepal Bar Association and a nonprofit called Women Lawyers Joining Hands, which is actually based in Canada, but is there to empower Nepali women lawyers. And so it's interesting because Nepal not only is one of the least developed countries in the world, but the women lawyers only make up about 10% of the lawyers in the country. And of course, they've experienced challenges that many of us could not even imagine in terms of becoming lawyers in the first place and then trying to really work on developing their careers. They just have not had the same opportunities as their male counterparts. And so this project is really designed to empower them and to build their capacity there on the ground. There is a new constitution in Nepal, and there are certain provisions that encourage and actually require women's participation. So this project is really important in terms of building their capacity so they can really take on these leadership roles in their country. So we trained 60 women lawyers for 8 days in December, which is where I was. We had 30 women lawyers who had been to our training in the past, and then 30 new women lawyers. And the idea is to really try to build a sustainable network among the women there between the times that our teams of lawyers are there on the ground. So there's, as I said, this is the fourth trip that we've taken. So we've actually trained now over 120 women Nepali lawyers, and they're really building a network among themselves. I had the great pleasure of telling people that I serve on this board of governors and that our president is a woman lawyer. They wanted to hear all about that, the women that I was with. And just the energy and the excitement among these women lawyers is really so exciting to see. Their level of confidence between day one that we were there and then the last day when they were getting up and presenting and talking about how they were going to take what they learned and apply it. was really exciting, and I wish all of you could have seen that. So that's where I was. I have a couple of new perimeter brochures that I'm happy to pass around. The cover photo on this one is actually from Nepal. You can see a little bit about it. And we do have a website if anyone's interested where we have more information about this particular project. But it's a great example of a bar association really getting behind something in a country where there is such a great need and things that we can do as lawyers to really contribute. So thank you, Esther. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Lisa, and thanks to DLA Piper as well for this small initiative and dedicating your time personally to be there and to serve the needs of the women lawyers as in an emerging market. I really appreciate it and sharing that experience and being an emissary on behalf of the DC Bar. Yeah.
Thank you.
The second item that I'd like to turn to is to applaud one of our board members who had a recent victory in his pro bono case. I'm going to highlight Ted Howard, who, as you know, is a pro bono counsel at Wiley Rhine, and he has had this hard-fought, well-earned victory in one of the cases that his firm has been extremely involved in, and they got a positive decision last week that really vindicated all of their efforts and helps to protect constitutionally guaranteed medical assistance for women prisoners. It was a suit against the Virginia Department of Corrections, and so perhaps Ted, you can share the meaning of this decision and what it means to those who are impacted.
Thank you, Esther.
Sorry to call on you by surprise.
Have been working with the Washington Lawyers Committee and the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville for basically starting in 2008 with the due diligence investigation that resulted in a class action lawsuit that we brought in federal district court in the Western District of Virginia, the Charlottesville Division, in 2012. Basically alleging systemic denial of adequate medical care to the 1,200 women who reside at this prison. The Department of Corrections contracts out its medical care to a private for-profit company that, not surprisingly, earns more money by shortchanging the care. And it has resulted over the years in many tragedies, including a number of deaths that were wholly unnecessary as a result of just really negligent medical care. Negligence, of course, is not in and of itself sufficient to establish violation of the Eighth Amendment. We have to show deliberate indifference to the serious medical needs of our clients. The state was sufficiently satisfied that we had or had done that or were on the verge of doing that in November of 2014 on the eve of trial to settle with us. We got a comprehensive settlement agreement that basically provided every bit of relief that we would have gotten if we had gone to trial and won on every issue, including a court-appointed monitor who goes to the prison four times a year to evaluate the quality and quantity of care and advise the prison on what it needs to be doing to improve. There was a provision in the settlement agreement that provided for enforcement by way of contempt in the event that they didn't fulfill their obligations. In September of 2017, we had gotten to the point where we were pretty well convinced that the state was not living up to its obligations. We filed a contempt proceeding that resulted in a one-week trial in June of 2018, which caused me to miss your investiture, Esther. And we had extensive post-trial briefing through the summer, and we got a decision on January 2nd. Denying a holding of contempt on a fairly technical issue under the federal rules, but the essentially granting us otherwise all of the findings that we requested and all of the relief that we requested on behalf of the women. And so we'll start all over again in terms of trying to see if maybe this time being beat about the head and shoulders, not once but twice, will be sufficient for the Department of Corrections to just fulfill its obligations under the Constitution.
Thank you, Ted, for your tremendous work and the impact that you're making in the lives of many. Finally, I'd like to recognize and applaud another board member who's on the phone, Leslie Thornton, who, after many years of distinguished career and service as general counsel of Washington Gas Light and WGL Holdings, finally stepped down and is enjoying her well-deserved time off, even though she's already very busy with many different boards and continued service to the community. I'd like to call upon Ben Wilson to say a few words about Leslie, whom he knows very well and has worked with in the past.
Well, thank you, Esther. It's first of all, it's an honor to recognize Leslie. She has been a terrific leader of our bar, general counsel, in addition to doing superb work on behalf of her clients. She took every opportunity to find opportunity for women and attorneys of color to do work on behalf of Washington Gas Holdings. But Leslie has been recognized for far more than that. She's been recognized by the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. She's been recognized by the University of District of Columbia School of Law. She's been recognized as the General Counsel of the Year. And so she's touched so many lives. And just last week, about 50 plus of her friends gathered together to recognize Leslie. I would also note that you can see what she has done, the things that she has done in a very quiet and understated way on behalf of young people seeking an education, on behalf of our African American History Museum. It really is a remarkable record, and I count myself quite fortunate to count her as a friend. So I hope you'll join me saluting Leslie warmly, and we love her, and we appreciate her, and she makes everything better by her presence, even on the phone.
So, hey Ben, would you tell the the event that's on the 14th Street Bridge that I'm stuck in to recognize me and let me go by?
Well, thank you, Ben, for sharing Leslie's accomplishments with us, and congratulations to Leslie. Even though you're on the phone, we applaud you and give you a big round of hand.
I just got around whatever that actually was a five. I shouldn't joke about that. But now that I'm around it, it was a 5-car accident on the 14th Street Bridge. With cars turned around and upside down. So I'm gonna actually hang up now and finish making my way there. And I will see you shortly. Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate it, Esther. I'll see you shortly.
Thank you, Leslie. Travel safely.
Well, if I say so myself, I think that was the best president's report yet. We're very fortunate to have such distinguished and accomplished and dedicated board members, and I feel very privileged and fortunate to be working with each and every one of you. So that was very nice to share as we start off the year. Moving to the more mundane, the consent agenda. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. We now turn to you, Amy, for the treasurer's report.
Okay. Okay, so we'll start on page 4. You'll see that for November, the DC Bar operations from combined dues and non-dues activities generated a surplus of $241,000. The client security fund had an income of $500. It's not a typo, really, just $500. Along with a modest gain generated by the investment portfolio of $133,000, leaving us in a good place for the end of November with a surplus of $375,000. Year to date, we have generated a net surplus of $1.2 million from operations. When you compare this to the year-to-year budgeted deficit of $524,000, we are $1.7 million ahead. Net investment earnings through November were losses of $126,000. We ended the period with a positive change in net assets of $1.1 million. So let's turn to page 5, which is the dues funded programs. Year to date, we budgeted a loss from operations of $468,000. Instead, the actual results from November show a surplus of $1 million. And this is $1.5 million better than budget. Our revenue is ahead of budget by $107,000. Members' dues exceeded budget by $199,000 due to late fees and penalties. Rent revenue reflects a negative variance to budget of $216,000. We have now begun to recognize rent on the retail space, but the office space has not, which has not been rent, contributes to the variance. Okay, higher miscellaneous revenue reflects interest income on our tenant improvements escrow, parking garage revenue, and an increase in disciplinary certificates by ODC. Total expenses are under budget by $1.4 million. Personnel expenses below budget due to health insurance savings. Costs related to the studio and building modifications have completed beta testing and are awaiting final inspection and were therefore not depreciated. This is reflected as a savings for depreciation and amortization. The final inspection should be completed by the end of this month. Savings related to the depreciation will be permanent for this fiscal year. Dues funded activities generally show lower than expected expenses except for equipment, lease, and services, food and beverage, legal research and publications, and supplies. Investment returns for November were gains of $96,000, resulting in $91,000 in negative returns to date. Does anyone have questions about the dues funded programs?
I have one question. Well, I may have two questions, Amy.
Okay.
One is, there's a reference on the first page of the memo, the front page of the memo, with respect to licensing fees in the top part of the memo, the last bullet point. There's a reference to an in-reach project not being pursued. I wasn't sure what the in-reach project was.
I'll defer to someone else who knows about the in-reach project.
It was the design of the website.
Okay.
It's been delayed all month.
Okay, thanks. And then my other question about, I think it relates to dues funded numbers, is the over budget number for supplies is kind of substantial, and I'm just curious to know whether that's a matter of timing, and over the year that'll even out, if anybody knows.
It's timing,
okay.
Yeah, the budget is... Mm-hmm. Is being spread evenly over 12 months, but the purchases are ebbing
right.
And flowing.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Right. To follow up on, Pat's question, what is the status of the web redesign?
So the web redesign would be, we will start an RFP for the website design early on March. I'm not sure you can hear me. So we're looking at starting the project around March, but this project was, I guess, 100% in this fiscal year. Chances are there will be partial in this fiscal year, but then complete by 2019, but which is half of it in the next fiscal year. So it's a shift in expenses.
I have a follow-up question about the InReach project. So we decided not to pursue it, and as a result, we saved $391,000. Is that what that is about? The timing of renewal
process monthly budget.
So now the it's actually more about the timing than the doing it or not doing it. Is because it will go across two fiscal years. The expenses on this fiscal year will not be as significant. So it's just that the burn rate is different. So we didn't start in July. We will not start until March, and with March being the engagement of different groups that have to be involved and so on. So we'll really start spending money on the project very close to the end of the fiscal year, and then it will be the next fiscal year. Indeed, it's actually budgeted for next fiscal year.
They should actually have yet at the end of that sentence instead of not pursued, not pursued yet.
I see. Okay, so, so yes. Part of this money is going to be spent.
Right. Okay. And in probably it's not going to even be in reach. I mean, we are not sure how the selection of that specific software was made. The scope of the project has slightly shifted following the net. What we learned about the net forum system. So we'll need to really look at the scope again and redesign.
Do we have a mechanism in place to adjust the budget to reflect delayed timing of certain items, such as the depreciation, which is going to be carrying at $543,000 for the remainder of the year? It kind of distorts our actual performance versus budget. I'm just wondering if there is anything that we can do to show those adjustments on a go-forward basis.
So, the board approved a budget, and in that budget, depreciation was one of those components, and there was an annual amount. So what we are doing in the finance department, as we become aware of some of these timing issues, we can adjust the budget going forward, but not backwards, because we've already reported on that. So for some of the larger ticket items, yeah, we do try to do that, but we, you know, we can't catch them all, but.
I'm thinking more of these particularly large items and for reporting to the Board of Governors.
Right. We are trying to do that. We don't catch them all. So now that I know that this is a specific one, we'll make sure that we adjust it going forward.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's turn to page 12, which covers communities. Communities had a net surplus from operations year-to-date of $74,000, which is $104,000 better than the budgeted loss. Membership dues revenue for communities is $35,000, or 5% less than budget. Personnel expenses are less than budget by $89,000 due to staff vacancies and lower fringe costs. All other expense categories were on or under budget. Any questions about the communities report? Okay, so if you'll turn to page 13, we'll talk about CLE not funded by member dues. So non-dues CLE reflects a surplus from operations year to date of $80,000. This is better than budget by $54,000. Registration revenue includes $13,000 related to the passport program. The positive variance to budget of $33,000 in books and publication sales is for the on-demand CLE. Total revenue is $44,000, or 11% better than budget. Expenses are below budget by $10,000. Food and beverage is significantly over the annual budget. This is related in part to the Aging in DC event and is offset by sponsorship revenue of $13,000. Other fees and services expense in particular is significantly below budget due to lower than expected payments for accreditation fees. Any questions about the non-dues CLE? Okay, so let's turn to page 14. We will talk about other non-dues activities. Other non-dues activities reflected on this report include certificates of good standing, royalty payments related to member affinity programs, the broadcast studio, and sales of the practice manual. Other fees and services revenue year to date did better than budget by $128,000. This is related to certificates of good standing. The volume of requests for the certificates continues to be higher than expected. In response, effective December 1, we adopted a new pricing model, which increased the price by 50% for the most popular products, same day and next day delivery. Royalties revenue continues to significantly exceed budget. In particular, our insurance affinity programs are exceeding expectations. Royalties are $22,000 or 117% better than budget. These affinity partnerships include GEICO, Avis Budget, Your Membership Career Centers, and UPS. Any questions about the other non-dues activities?
Where is the studio listed? What line item is that under? Broadcast studio.
That's in other fees and services rec. It's a roll-up of that.
So the other fees and services revenue, that certificate of good standing, it's part of it.
Yes.
What else is in there? Is it possible to break it down so we can see how much money we're coming in from now on out?
Yes.
That'd be great.
We
Thank
can
you.
Certainly do that.
So what other it's rolled into that line item? Certificate of good standing, the studio, and what
else? Those are the two biggest ones.
Okay. Is there any reason why we decided to roll it up into one line item?
No. other than the past practice has been to roll those types of things up. Obviously, studio is new.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, naturally put it in there, but we can certainly take it out. That's not an issue.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful for the studio, for, at least for me.
Sure.
You know, since it's new, so we can see how it's doing.
Thank you.
So, to finish, we'll turn to the budget balance sheet, rather, which is on the last page, page 16.
Oh, I'm sorry. One quick question on other non-dues. Maybe you've said this, and I apologize. The other personnel and staff augmentation, I assume that that's to cover the higher demand for the certificates, or is there another explanation?
That's
for that?
Exactly it.
Okay.
The temporary staff that we use to administer that program.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on page 16, we'll talk about the balance sheet. Overall, you will notice that we continue to see a significant increase compared to last year, both in assets and liabilities. Again, primarily driven by the building. Cash increased by $3.8 million compared to this time last year, where we had higher levels of spending to complete work on the building. Investments decreased by $291,000 to our current balance of $11.8 million. The combined cost of land and building is just shy of $67 million. There continues to be about $9 million of work in progress related to building modifications in the studio, which has completed beta testing as mentioned and is awaiting final inspection. Total liabilities reflect an increase of $28 million compared to the same period last year due to the mortgage on the building, which is currently at $58 million, and the sublease liability currently at $8.8 million. Any questions about the balance sheet?
I have a question about the sublease liability. Why is it reflected in 2018 and 19, but not 2017 and 18?
Because when we moved into this building, which was in February of 2018, at that point in time, generally accepted accounting principles require us, because we have abandoned our old location, it requires us to, and I know that we talked about this before when we did the lease loss, you know, ad nauseum, but it requires us to do a calculation at that point in time of our continuing obligation in terms of rent payments for 1101 K Street, and then we offset it against estimates of sublease income for that that same square footage over there,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever that calculation comes out to be, that becomes the lease loss, which we are required to report immediately.
So what remind me, because I remember at one of the board meetings we talked about writing off about the line below the line.
Yes.
Is that what this is?
Yes. So when you look at the FY 2018 financial report, the audit report, you will see on the income statement the lease loss recognition below the line. So you'll see all of the activity related to operations, and you'll see the number, and then below that number, you will see the lease loss, because it's considered not a result of continuing operation per se. It's kind of a one-off thing.
Okay.
So we recognize it below the line. The offset to that, as you know, in accounting, there's debits and credits, uh-huh. and they have to offset each other. The offset for that is recorded as a liability on the balance sheet, and that's what you're seeing here as being reduced as we continue to make rent payments and as we continue to get rent sublease income from over there. It's all kind of running through that sublease liability. So you'll see that gradually going down as we get closer okay. to, you know, reaching the termination of our lease.
I see. So it's a okay. So let me show you. So it's an accounting practice,
yes.
and it's one time writing off below the line.
Correct.
But as money comes in, it will go underneath to go under the line to balance it out or to even it out.
So there's a one time recognition. Boy, you are getting really into the. That's okay. I love it. So we have this one-time recognition mm-hmm. in FY18 of this loss, and that is on the income statement, and that's where it is. It's shown below the line. So at the end of 2018, what we do is we roll all the activity from the income statement, and we move it into net assets, right? Because we start fresh in FY19 with income and expenses. So that loss has been recorded in the net assets. And the offset to that loss is shown as a liability on the balance sheet. Okay? So now we're in FY19, we're continuing to make rent payments. Normally when you make a rent payment, it's an expense. But because we have recognized that entire loss in the past fiscal year, that rent payment is going towards reducing this liability.
Okay.
And so you will see that.
And where would it show up on the balance sheet when we start putting them?
So if you look, on the balance sheet, which is the report that Amy was just referencing, under liabilities, it's uh-huh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 line down under liabilities. And it says sublease liability,
right.
and it's $8.8 million. If you remember when we originally recorded the lease loss for FY18, it was over $10.5 million, and now it's 8.8.
Oh, I see.
So you can see
but that number is going to go down from now on.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Exactly. November and October. Okay. You can see it's already going off to the right.
Okay.
As of November,
yep,
you can see it's already going
yep.
down.
Got it. Okay. Get it. Thank you so much. It's just a lot of money. It just I just kind of want to make sure I understand what's going on. Thank you.
Any other questions about the balance sheet? Statement of activities. Statement of financial position. Just the proper name, the name of the balance sheet.
Yes, I'm very old school. It's yeah. the balance sheet to me.
That concludes my report.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Mark.
In the interest of time, why don't we revise the agenda item so that we roll into the executive session of the CEO's report, and we'll now move directly to the annual report of the Practice Management Advisory Service by Dan Mills. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Everyone.
Good afternoon.
I'm Dan Mills, and I'm one of two practice management advisors here at the bar. The other being Rochelle Washington. She can't be with us today because she's a bit under the weather. So I'm going to make our annual report. So what we do in the Practice Management Advisory Service is we help lawyers with business issues. And we do it in a number of different ways, with the goal being that they're better lawyers, provide better services to their clients, and then at the same time stay out of trouble. So how do we do that? We have a service where lawyers can call and email us And we do that on a regular basis. We get, you know, calls and emails every day, some days more than others, where we're engaged with lawyers and responding and helping them, giving them guidance. All the services that we do on a one-on-one basis are free and confidential as well. And Rule 1.6J applies to what we do. Otherwise, I'm not so sure lawyers would talk to us if there was some fear that if they confessed to a rule violation, we'd have to report them to Office of Disciplinary Counsel. So we can't do that. So we do it individually in that way. We also provide assessments, and this is where we meet with lawyers one-on-one, sometimes individual lawyers, sometimes it's a firm, typically a small firm. The big firms don't tend to bring us in. They tend to do this sort of thing in-house. But we'll come into a firm and do a, you know, top to bottom assessment, let them know what they're doing right, you know, where their soft spots are and that kind of thing. Most of the time we do those here in one-on-one sessions with lawyers. Occasionally we'll be asked to, you know, to come into a firm, and when we do, we make an effort to talk to everybody, staff, lawyers, everyone that works there. And so in addition to the assessments, we have the number of publications that we keep up to date, revise, the primary one being our e-manual for some of our ongoing programs. And then we do a number of educational programs as well. The one that we have done the longest is called Basic Training and Beyond. We have a session tomorrow. We do it pretty much every month. And we have for over 10 years now. Presently, it's a two-day program, and it helps lawyers get a law firm up and going in the District of Columbia. That course spun off a more in-depth course that we do annually called the Successful Small Firm Practice course. That's in its fifth or sixth year of operation at the present time. We do every month a series of lunch and learn programs, which are over the noon hour, on topics that are useful to attorneys. And then we have our big all-day program that we do once a year called Practice 360. And last year when we did that program, which is in the report, it was the first year that we charged for it. In the past, it had always been free. And last year we charged a nominal sum to attend in the hopes that more of the people who actually register would show up. And it had that effect.
What was the nominal amount?
It depended upon what you signed up for, but it was in the range of $30. For members, depending upon whether they took the CLEs, you know, signed up for the CLEs or not. For non-members, they were allowed to come, and I think it was close to $100, and there were four or five that paid that. So it was essentially all DC bar members that come to that. So that's pretty much it. All the details are in the report in terms of numbers and all that sort of thing. Any questions?
Dan, is it your intention to continue the practice of charging for the Practice 360?
That's the plan.
Yeah.
That's the plan, and that seems to work better. And what we were experiencing were we would top out immediately when it was free. You know, there'd be 350 people sign up for it, and then about 100 to 120 would actually show up. And that made it difficult to plan for the people that were sponsoring it and all that sort of thing. So it seems to work out better. A program of this nature in other bars runs $300 to $500. So our fees are still extremely low for this sort of program.
The report says you had 83 members who attended. So were you satisfied with that kind of turnout, or would you like to bump that up?
Oh no, we weren't satisfied. It was adequate. It rained that day. Whenever it rains for a program like, you know, they have a program like this, it impacts attendance. When the weather's nicer, we get more people. Hopefully this year, you know, when we do it again, we'll get lucky and the weather will be good.
So not that this is an exact barometer, but do you see any trends in terms of more people wanting to start practices, or is your enrollment up in general, or do you have any way of assessing that?
Well, you know, our numbers in basic training were much higher than they are now when we started it, but it was back in 2008 when we began it, and big firms were laying off on a regular basis. And primarily, the people that were coming in 08, 09, and 10 were recently laid off lawyers, either from firms, you know, sometimes from the government, sometimes in-house. And they tended to be younger and less experienced. It's evened out a bit. We don't have nearly those numbers any longer, I think in part because things have sort of leveled out in the profession. And now that our attendees tend to be way more experienced lawyers in their careers, but typically not a lot of experience running their own firm. You know, they've been in-house, they've been in a big firm, they've been in the government, they've done one thing and only one thing about which they're expert, but they have really no idea how to start and run a firm. And that is still steady. I mean, they're still, you know, it appears to me nobody's retiring. They're either leaving firms for various reasons, but they're not stopping, you know.
Can you, I'm just curious about the types of issues that people come to you, not obviously associated with anybody, but I'm just wondering about the kind of issues people come to that they're worried about.
All sorts of things. Primarily, I would say it's you know, what do I need to do to start? And once I'm started, what do I need to do to get business, to get clients? How do I market once I'm started? And then when we drill down on those kinds of issues, we get into all sorts of things in terms of what they want their firm to be about, the bank accounts they need to set up, how they need to handle money. A lot of basics. I mean, a lot of real basics. I'm sorry?
Do they talk about advertising?
Marketing is a huge topic. Yeah, huge topic.
Is that where that some members get in trouble?
They don't get in trouble in marketing because our jurisdiction, you know, has a, I mean, our rule is I like to say it's almost libertarian compared to other jurisdictions. Yeah. You know, don't mislead, don't confuse any claim you make, be able to support it factually, and that's it. We don't have any process like Florida and other jurisdictions do where you have to get pre-approval. So I've been here 11 years now. I can't think of a time I've talked to a lawyer who's been in trouble for marketing. I think you'd really have to light the sky up to get noticed. But where, you know, marketing is a topic for lawyers, and so it's not so much they violate the rule as they just make mistakes in going about it, you know. I mean, they sort of think there's a silver bullet for doing it. They think there's a one-size-fits-all approach to it. So it's a really complicated, challenging problem.
Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, I was curious on the Practice 360 session. Obviously, it's geared towards attorneys. Is there enough content that would also be attractive to other professional service providers, say, for example, those who serve the legal community or with law firms as their clients? Is that a potential source of additional demand, or is the way it's set up really just more focused on how to be a business, in the business of practicing law?
It's really set up more in terms of practical content for law firms and lawyers. I think if we went in that direction, you know, we'd really have to figure out why we wanted to do that and exactly where we wanted to go with it. We get sponsors, you know, from all over the place who see lawyers as part of their target. But I'm not so sure that, you know, I mean, I think enough on our plate in order to make it really relevant, you know, for the membership. And I'm not so sure we want to go outside that.
Do you cover IOLTA and sort of the financial management part of making sure they?
In what we do?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, you're very detailed. You're very detailed. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, I do the day one part of the basic training program, and we spend, depending upon the number of people there and the questions we get, anywhere from an hour to 2 hours on that. And I have props that I've developed to do this, because it makes a lot more sense if you can visualize handling money. And so I created bank accounts out of those upright paper towel stands, and I have red and green rings representing earned fees, red rings representing client funds that go into the IOLTA, and we commingle and we misappropriate and we get this part and all kinds of things. But when you can see it visually, it makes a whole lot of sense. If any of you ever saw Gene Shipp do the mandatory course, he would pull money out of his pocket, and one hand is earned fees, one hand is, you know, and he put them together and put them in one pocket and say 6 months off. So I sort of stole from Gene. But it's very elementary. But I never had one person complain and say, you know, I was insulted. The thing was so basic. I mean, in fact, it just generates all kinds of questions when they actually see it visually and get a sense of what's involved and you know, how you wind up earning the money that's in the trust account and so on. And I mean, I have talked to many, many, many brilliant lawyers who did not have a clue about how to handle money and what the whole purpose of a trust account was and all that kind of thing. And it's just because they never had to do it in their firm. Somebody else was always doing that, you know. So yeah, we spend a lot of time on that.
Well, thank you, Dan, for your work and the comprehensive report. I think this is one of the very valuable services that the bar provides for its members, and not all the members know about it. So as you meet members who may benefit from this service, please tell them about PM. AS, don't forget the A. So thank you again for coming.
Now I'll turn to you, Pat, for the report on behalf of the audit committee.
All right. Last week, the audit committee met with our auditors from Tate and Tryon, who have finished up their work on the audit of the last fiscal year's financial statements. And the auditors reviewed with us three sets of materials. One is their required communications letter, and you have all these three materials that were circulated just, I think, yesterday. And if you haven't had time to review them and you want time to review them and ask questions about them at a later board meeting, I'm sure we can accommodate you, but I thought it would be helpful to get them in front of you while they're timely. So the first set of materials they reviewed with us was the required communications letter, in which Tate and Tryon described that they had reviewed management's, among other things, management's estimates, assumptions, and disclosures made in the preparation of the financial statements and found them all to be acceptable and appropriate and consistent with accounting standards, reported that they had encountered no difficulties with the staff in conducting the audit, no disagreements with the staff in finalizing the numbers. They did recommend during the course of the audit one correction to the financial statements in a non-material amount of about $58,000, which relates to valuing an interest rate swap agreement that the bar has with SunTrust in connection with the mortgage. That's a $58,000 adjustment in the bar's favor, and the staff accepted that recommendation and adjusted the financial statements accordingly. So that was, in sum and substance, the required communications letter. In the management letter, Tate and Tryon made clear to us that they were not offering an opinion on the effectiveness of the bar's internal control, which was not expected. I mean, the auditors are hired to audit the financial statements and not to review and express an opinion on the effectiveness of internal control. And so they made clear that they hadn't done that, but they take the opportunity in their management letter to report any items that they think represent a deficiency in internal controls that rise to the level of a material weakness, and all of those are accounting terms of art. They confirmed that they did not see any deficiencies that rose to the level of a material weakness. They also reported that, or made recommendations to the bar to be attentive to a changing accounting standard that will be in effect next year, 2020, not this year, on revenue recognition. The bar is already aware of that and is taking that into account as it prepares for the future. The management letter also reported on the status of recommendations made in three prior management letters, one from 2017 on employee expense reporting and supervisory review of employee expenses, and they noted the progress the bar has made on that area, and two recommendations from their 2014 audit, one on the disaster recovery plan, which the bar has made progress on and expects to finalize this year, and another on adopting generally accepted privacy principles, which the bar has accomplished through its adoption of a security and privacy program in 2018. We asked the auditors, and they said that they thought that with respect to those areas, the bar was either at or ahead of where they typically see their nonprofit organization clients. So they weren't concerned about the progress. And then the last set of materials that they reviewed with us were the audited financial statements and their opinion letter. You'll see that they offered a clean opinion. That is, they found that the financial statements accurately reported the financial condition of the bar, and they had no reservations about that opinion. And the financial statements are there for your review. We've already talked with the treasurer about current financial performance. I would also say that we had an executive session with the auditors outside the presence of staff, which is common once a year to have that kind of a session, and nothing memorable came out of that. And in the presence of the staff, the auditors were very complimentary about both the level of cooperation that they got from the staff and the level of competency in finance and accounting matters that the staff displayed. And that's my report.
How long have we been?
I asked that question of them about 4 or 5 years, and we have talked internally. We've talked at the committee level about launching an RFP process.
Sally? On page 3 of the management letter, there's reference to litigation and it regarding the recoupment of $95,000. And it says the legal proceedings are in the discovery phase. As a new member of the board, this is all rather mysterious to me, but I am interested in what the status of the litigation is. And I don't know whether that's directed to you or...
I think we may speak about litigation more generally at some point later, but okay. That relates to one particular matter, which we talked about before.
Yeah, I think the intention was, Sally, to, in any detail, talk about that litigation matter in executive session.
Thank you.
I have a question. So on the same page that Sally was mentioning, on the management response, the second bullet, second sentence, it pertains to credit cards that the...
The organization consider creating a formal credit card policy. So the sentence that Annette's referring to is the cards are primarily limited to primarily limited to directors and upper level management with a handful of exceptions.
And then if you go down to second paragraph. As well, in 2018, management implemented a new credit card policy and has reduced the number of issued credit cards from 70 to 53. It seems like a large number of out issued credit cards within the bar.
The most
The most significant part of that number resides with Office of Disciplinary Counsel that insisted on having their attorneys have individual credit cards.
Okay.
We have called them back here at headquarters to primarily, not exclusively, but primarily managers and directors. But the biggest chunk of that number, 53, mm-hmm. is ODC.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a particular reason why the ODC attorneys require the use of credit cards?
It's mostly by tradition and practice. They typically use it most for travel, local travel, and some food, which is what we had been doing in-house. And we set up a DC bar-wide Uber account. They were not inclined to follow that path along the way, and so rather than forcing the issue, we but we do obviously monitor the credit card usage fairly carefully.
Thank you.
I have one question on the consolidated statement and financial position on page 2. Under liability and net assets, and further down on the board designated mandatory due purpose, there's a discrepancy between 2018 and 2017. 2017 was 18 million, and 2018 was 10 million 5. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Why is that such a big discrepancy between the 2 years of the mandatory due purpose for net assets, liability?
Mark,
I can take that.
Good, thank you. I don't
have the answer. That area refers to deferred revenue. And as you know, we have a due season that starts in May, right? So we're going to start in May of 2019. But what we're really doing is we're collecting dues for FY20.
Uh-huh.
So what it does is it requires us to, when we collect the money, we recognize the cash, obviously, as it comes in, but we aren't, in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, we aren't allowed to recognize that collection of money as revenue until it's earned.
Okay.
And the other thing that I would highlight is the fact that, and so when it's not part of revenue, it's in deferred revenue, which is a liability on the books. And that means that we owe you as members, you know, membership in this organization. And because you're paying for dues for a 12-month period, mm-hmm. we have to recognize 1/12 every month.
Okay.
So the difference here is just the collection of dues that's related to the mandatory or the dues-funded activities and where how much we had deferred or
right.
collected 1 year versus the other.
So would it be like a prorated amount? That is that
yes.
the way to look at it?
Yes. So if you look on, and when Amy was highlighting in her report, if you look at deferred revenue, and it's shown a little bit differently here in terms of nomenclature. We showed as deferred revenue on our internally generated ones. They have different ones here for the audit. You will see that goes down every month. As the year goes on, because we're recognizing a little bit of that revenue each month.
Got it.
This just shows a difference in how much we had collected in 1 year versus the other by June.
So, does the same thing apply to page 3, very bottom, net assets end of year, that the difference between 2017 and 2018, the difference is between at 2017, it was 27.8 million, and then 2018, it's 19.3 million.
Yes. I mean, that's part of it. That is part of it. But when you're talking about net assets, you're talking about the conglomeration of all of the activities of the bar, mm-hmm. all of the programs, all roll into net assets at the end of every year.
So I guess that's what I don't understand. With having the building, I thought we are the our revenue or our assets, it's more than previously because of the real estate market. So shouldn't our 2018 net assets end of the year money shouldn't be better than 2017?
Well, remember, we have the lease loss.
Okay.
And that was $10.5 million. So that directly impacts net assets.
Okay.
To follow up, and I probably should have raised this at the committee meeting, but so the reduction in that mandatory dues purpose balance, which is prepayments, if you will, mm-hmm. of $8.2 million, does that reflect any change in operations? Or does that, did we do anything different in terms of trying to collect money ahead of time?
We implemented a new association management system last year, and in the run-up to due season, we were very cautious because there were a number of glitches that we were working out. So when we were in May, which is typically when we push the email system very hard to get folks to go ahead and renew, we did a very slow roll so we could adjust any issues, which is why a lot of the revenue came in after June 30th this year, as opposed to prior.
Okay, so we would expect to see something close to the 2017 experience this
yes.
year.
That's correct. Yeah, this year, all goes according to schedule, we should be able to launch full scale on May 1st.
Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments regarding the draft audit reports?
You mentioned, Pat, that this is not an action item.
Right. The board does not have to move to accept or adopt the auditor's report. It's just the minutes will reflect that the report was made to the board.
All right. Then with that, before we move to the executive session, I'd like to recognize Andrea Williams, who's the Director of Communications. She and her team put together a wonderful issue of the Washington Lawyer in December that focused on the pro bono work and giving and the impact that the center is making. And it has really heartwarming stories about the great work that the pro bono center is doing. So I'd like to applaud the communications team for working hard to put that together, as well as the January issue, which is dedicated to highlighting another valuable service that the law provides, that's Lawyers Assistance Program, LAP, for those lawyers who require assistance with either substance abuse or alcoholism or stress management in dealing with legal practice. And it features some of the people who have benefited from the LAP service and what an impact and a difference that it has made in their personal and professional lives, and is a really remarkable issue. So if you haven't yet, I would encourage you to go through the December and January issues and share those stories. So thank you. And I'd like to also thank Amy Nelson for volunteering at Saturday's walk-in clinic, not as a volunteer, but as a mentor. She is an expert in benefits, and in one of my cases, she has counseled me and advised me. So personal thanks to you,
Amy.
So with that, let's now move into executive session.